Welcome to the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley, psychology student and international best-selling psychology author of over 30 psychology books, bringing you the latest psychology news, fascinating psychology topics and more each week. If you want to learn more, then please check out connorwhiteley.net/books. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube video or follow on your favourite podcast app. And here's the show. Hi everyone and welcome to episode 236 of the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley. And today's episode is on how does autism affect communication in therapy? And it is Saturday the 4th of November 2023 as I record this. So today is a really fun and really useful podcast episode for all of us, because even if we are aware of autism and the different communication difficulties that can lead to like someone to actually cause, the entire gap up between knowing about something and actually seeing it in a therapeutic setting, that's always real and that will always happen. So it's good to be aware about it. Just so in a case an autistic client or someone who is autistic but hasn't been officially diagnosed, or maybe they don't even know they're autistic, it's just so when these people come into our therapy rooms, then we can understand some of these communication symptoms and we aren't taken off a guard, or we aren't taken by surprise, or even worse, we don't misinterpret them as being rude, blunt and horrible. Because if we're like aware of this, then we can adapt our approach and we can help them, which is our job at the end of the day. Or at least once we're qualified. And no longer students. So you've got that to look forward to in the content part of today's episode. So moving on to the psychology news section, we're reading from the British Psychological Society Research Digest, and the first one is rather good. Being born slows rates of myelin growth. Preterm birth can have long-term cognitive consequences. Literature suggests that school children who were born at between 32 and 37 gestational weeks are more likely to have problems with memory and attention. For example, other studies have found that extreme preterm birth before 28 weeks of gestation is closely linked to long-term intellectual disability, problems with language and behaviour, cerebral palsy, and the development of psychiatric disorders. In a new paper in PNAS, a team led by Meshik Gondfebe at the University of Melbourg in Germany report finding what could be a key reason why preterm birth can have these impacts on the brain. Myelin, the fatty sheath that insulates the axon bodies of the neurons, appears to grow faster in the uterus than after birth. So there's actually not a lot that I can actually say about this one, but I suppose one of the reasons for this particular finding, and I'm sure if I read the paper in like any detail, then the authors probably actually mentioned where were the reason why. Yeah, but I remember when I was learning about this topic that one of the benefits of the myelin sheath is that you can have, I think it's something called the nodes of anon or something like that, or where the electrical signal is able to travel faster across the neurons because it basically skips over these myelin sheaths. So don't quote me on the name, but I remember that that's what happens. So without these sheaths, then the electrical impulses do just have to travel along the neuron normally, which leads to a slower processing. So I guess that's one of the reasons. So the second one is, framing jobs as for the greater good suppresses pay demands. And I think that I basically just split the podcast in half between managers publishers, which have just piqued their interest, and workers are going, oh my god, I need to listen just so I don't fall for this. When considering career options, candidates are often faced with a choice: a high salary for work that is potentially non-meaningful, or meaningful work that pays much less. Previous research has suggested that despite lower financial rewards and all the trouble that can bring, many people are willing to go for the second option. A new study published in Organizational Science explores the effects of social impact framing and perceived norms on pay demands, revealing what many of us, and many organizations no doubt, intuitively suspect. We're less likely to ask for a higher wage when our work seems meaningful. And even though I tend to stay away from positive psychology on the podcast, simply because it's something that does not interest me in the slightest, whether what we do also know from mental health research is that if someone does feel like they've got meaning and they're living a purposeful life, then they are happy. And if you're happy, you aren't going to ask for a pay rise. And I think this is one of the weird things about psychology, or at least clinical psychology, once you're qualified on the doctorate, which is really hard. Well, because clinical psychologists tend to get about 40,000, I saw a job recently which was like £80,000, and I was like, yeah, wow, that's amazing. I think it's quite interesting because we do meaningful work, but we also get a really high salary, which is really nice about clinical psychology. I know when you get up to the stupid money, like £80,000, I think at that point you basically do no clinical work and it's all you just sitting behind a desk, supervising and running departments and entire regions. So it's interesting, but I do think that if positive psychology has actually taught us anything, it's that if you're happy, if you're living a meaningful and a purposeful life, then you are going to be happy and your mental health is actually going to be really good too. So I think sometimes, or to be honest, probably most of the time, when you look for a job, go for something meaningful and maybe not necessarily about money. So the last one is elsewhere on the web. Neuroscience News breaks down the details of a recent study into a somewhat rarely studied topic: afterlife communication. Wow, okay then, I picked an interesting one. Which is defined as a perceived spontaneous contact with the deceased. The findings of the study covered suggest that it's surprisingly prevalent, with 30% to 34% of people experiencing at least one such event, such as seeing a departed loved one in a dream, or of the bereaved partners or spouses that took part in the research, 74% reported that it helped them to accept their loss. The authors emphasised the need for deeper understanding into this phenomenon and its potentially positive role in the grief process. Okay, I am not going to try and disrespect too many people's beliefs, but I think that if you're asking people and if you're asking for self-reported stuff, there is no way to measure this. This is not science. This is just asking someone if they've, because I think that it is really common. It is common, after someone's died, then yes, I think you are going to dream about them. And yes, I know psychology hasn't got a definitive answer about what are dreams, but if we go on one of the theories where you actually do have some input or some influence over your dreams, if you're thinking about that person a lot, then yes, you are going to dream about them. And also, if you've gone through a traumatic event, like someone dying, then yes, I think you would dream about that. Is it communicating with the dead? No, I don't think that for a single second. So I think people interpret it as communicating with the dead, especially when you're doing a research project on it. Then I've actually looked at this a particular study, but if this was a self-selected research sample, then I think you are going to get people that are more likely to believe in communicating with the dead as you go to this research, as you sign up for it. If I saw someone researching this topic, because I don't believe in communicating with the dead, I wouldn't sign up for it. So, I don't know. I think that, if I was really interested, I would look at this paper more, just to try and pick apart their methodology. But, self-reported data, which this implies to me, I don't think so. It's just not a very good way to research this. Then again, I don't know if we have any other methods. And to be honest, I do understand why this is a very studied topic, because it's really hard to measure with any science, with any empirical nature, but it does have the potential positive role in the grieving process. So I guess it's something to think about. But yeah, just weird, just communicating with the dead. Would I really want to? Would I? What if a dead person says horrible stuff about you and then you can't communicate with them again? I think that would be a lot more devastating than the good it would do. Okay, so I hope you enjoy the psychology news section. So let's move on to the personal update. So we're moving on to the personal update. So this I actually am going to keep rather short, because there will be a podcast episode at some point in the future about my work experience up in Newcastle. So that was really good. I really enjoyed it. Granted, I did have a bit of a meltdown at the various points. Not because of the work, not because of the people. They were honestly amazing. But me going up to Newcastle, away from everything that kept me grounded, away from everything that normally keeps my mental health in very good check, was probably a very stupid idea. So I did have to come back a little early. And this week I've just been trying to get back into the rhythm and the stuff. And counselling's really good at the uni. So I am okay. I am happy and I am back to normal now. But it was a bit of a rough week and quite a lot happened. So it was quite interesting. And yes, I always say it on this podcast, I always say in my books, we always learn in our lectures that mental health recovery is a journey, etc., etc. But now I am learning more about my triggers. I'm learning about how I keep myself okay for the long term, just so I don't keep having meltdowns whenever I try and do something new. So it's interesting. But university is good. There was a massive problem in the lab yesterday, because I've been helping my friend run his control group for his project. And there was technical issues. Thankfully, I'm quite humorous with the power pistons, so I was able to keep them interested and engaged. But I hate technology. At this point, I really do hate university technology. And I'm sure everyone can relate to that at some point. And tons of other good things have been happening too. So life is a good now. And I'm sure I'll be able to share more in depth stuff next week. And as always, I always love to know your thoughts and feelings on today's episode. So you can always email me, ConnorWiley@ConnorWiley.net. You can always leave a comment at the show notes at ConnorWiley.net/podcast. And you can always tweet me on Twitter at Sci-Fi Whiteley. I always love to hear from all of you, because it really helps make the podcast feel more like a conversation. And today's episode has been sponsored by Developmental Psychology, a guide to developmental and child psychology. So this is a great sponsor for today's episode, because not only does the book actually include an autism chapter, so you can understand autism even more, but it also talks about tons of other great topics which we talk about in today's episode, like language development, communication, and cognitive development, which will really in upon topics when it comes to autism. So even though those main sections of the book, which can go on for quite a few chapters and actually go into quite a lot of really interesting depth. Even though they aren't actually focused on autism specifically and they're like more general, but they're still critical to know and they're still fascinating. Because once we understand how neurotypical communication happens and how does that develop, then we are going to start to understand autistic communication and so on. So I love this book. It's really engaging, really thick. It contains a lot of great information. So I know that you're going to enjoy it. So that is Developmental Psychology, A Guide to Developmental and Child Psychology, available from all major ebook retailers, and you can buy the paperback and the hardback version from Amazon, your local bookstore or local library if you request it. And you can buy the ebook directly from me at payhip.com/ConWhiteley. Several whilst buying books helps us to support the editing and the creation of the podcast. My time is sponsored by my wonderful patrons. And if you wanted to become a patron and take tons of like great rewards, then you can come on at patreon.com/thepsychologyworldpodcast. So let's move on to the content part of today's episode. So we're moving on to the content part of today's episode. So we're going to be talking about how can autism affect communication in therapy. So this is a great episode. I really enjoyed it. And we're going to be looking at 10 different ways. So let's dive into it. Autistic clients might avoid eye contact in therapy. Whenever we think about autism, the idea of eye contact always comes up first in people's minds, and this is because autistic people tend to have problems with eye contact. For example, I cannot remember the last time I made eye contact with either of my therapists, and to be honest, really anyone in my life, because I simply don't like it, and I have no intention of making eye contact with someone, because the trick that I tend to use if I know it's important, sort of say that in air quotes, is that if you look at someone's nose, they think you're looking them in the eye. It's a great little trick. Equally, some autistic people don't look sideways or from a therapist for long periods of a time, because some autistic people stare intensely at someone to the point where the therapist might be uncomfortable. These are common in all autistic people. Although some more autistic people have learned to mask their symptoms by making eye contact in a natural way in an effort to hide their autism, this does have negative consequences, but it is a survival technique to help autistic people blend into this neurotypical world. Overall, if a client is avoiding eye contact with you or staring at you in intensity, they could be autistic. Autistic people provide a lot of detail and talk excessively. In addition, autistic people could talk to you for long, extensive periods of their time, as well as it includes a lot of detail that takes the conversation off on a lot of tangents. This could happen because the autistic client wants to share information about one of their special interests, or they might want to share something that they've recently become passionate about. Also, this info dumping, as the autistic community calls it, could happen because the client hasn't picked up on communication cues from the therapist about them wanting to talk or talk about something else. And personally, I think whether or not this is a problem, and I say in massive air quotes, really depends on the therapeutic model being used. For example, this would be an immense problem in cognitive behavioural therapy because it is so structured and rather rigid, so these tangents wouldn't be good. But for counselling or the humanistic approaches, I don't think this would be a problem. In fact, my own experience, it tends to be these wild tangents that actually tend to be quite golden for me and actually going on to actually explore and solve some of my mental health difficulties. This is my favourite one. Apparently being rude, direct or blunt. So I use the word apparently more for myself than anything else because I was a so-called rude child at times because of my undiagnosed autism. But anyway, one of the biggest communication challenges that autistic people face is coming across as rude to other people when in their minds, what they have just said is the truth and it sounds okay to them. That was basically the story of my childhood. Therefore, the vast majority of autistic clients prefer to communicate in a simple, direct and effective way, but this can sadly come across as rude to other people, as well as autistic people might struggle to understand metaphorical or vague language, so they communicate directly as it matches how they prefer to be communicated with. However, on a minor side tangent, I will admit that this flat out doesn't mean autistic people cannot understand metaphors and imagery in therapy settings, since my current counsellor, who actually ends the week this goes out, uses a lot of metaphor and imagery, and he mentions how autistic clients are actually very good at it, so I just wanted to clear up that myth. Overall, autistic clients might prefer to communicate directly and effectively with you as their therapist. So just bear in mind, if they're being a director, they are just talking and not trying to be rude or blunt with you. Autistic people might talk over or interrupt you. Similar to what I mentioned earlier, because autistic people tend to struggle with how much detail to add, picking up on social cues, amongst other communication cues, they might interrupt or talk over you. As well as because autistic people find it difficult to know when to join a conversation, they might say nothing, wait for a while to speak or interrupt you. My point is, if the client interrupts you, again, they aren't being rude. They are just being their authentic autistic self, which is actually one of the entire points of therapy. We want to help our current or future clients be themselves and help them deal with whatever mental health difficulty they're facing. Slower verbal processing times. Oh, also, I should actually say up front here that all the references, and there's actually quite a lot, they're all on the blog post at conorwhiteley.net/podcast. Go to today's episode and they're at the bottom of the post. Interestingly, Haig et al. 2018 found that autistic people might take longer to process verbal information. This is important for therapists to be aware of, because if you tend to ask your client a lot of multi-part questions, then this might work for neurotypical clients. Yet you might be disadvantaging your autistic clients by accident, so asking single-part questions might be better. Lack of facial expression. Now, I will be the first to admit that most forms of emotional processing are massively difficult for autistic people, to the point where it can be funny, because if I'm talking with other autistic people though, we actually tend to joke about it, because I asked out my friend on a date the other week for the first time ever, and they rejected me, and then we were talking about it the next day, and I said I was fine, because emotionally I was, but the weird thing was that my body was shaking, probably being upset, and I just couldn't sleep that night, so I was fine emotionally, but my body was just like, no, you are not okay. So when I told my friend this, they basically said, yes, I've had that before, and I can't understand my own emotions, so I have to listen to my body to tell me how I'm feeling. And yeah, I definitely agree with that. Plus, I also find it funny how me and my friends, and basically all the other autistic people I know, we can show limited expressions of emotion in a person, but if we're texting each other and so on, we are a lot more expressive, because it's just easier to be emotional through word choice, emojis, etc. in text. Anyway, I think that we can all understand that many autistic adults don't use their faces to express emotion the same way neurotypical adults do, and some autistic people might look extremely serious regardless of the situation or the informality of the situation they're in. Loudly or quietly talking of a strange pitch, rhythm or tone. Something I've actually noticed during this podcast episode, because I actually wanted to look at it for a moment. This was something I was very surprised to learn a few years ago, but I think there tends to be two types of voice categories, again air quotes, that autistic people fall into. Because there's the monotone camp, or there's the type of a camp where autistic people speak in a certain rhythm. And I think I'm definitely in the latter category, because my voice does change with emotion, but there are certain sounds, words or patterns that I talk in. And I think long-term listeners have probably figured that out. But I will admit, it can make editing the podcast a nightmare at times. Anyway, Bowen et al. 2011 suggests that autistic people might struggle to control their voices. So this could make a client talk loudly, quietly, have a intonation in a strange place, or have little to no intonation. Not being able to talk during sessions. On the other hand, there might be some autistic people who aren't non-verbal, but they find it very hard to talk about themselves. This could be because they find it difficult to articulate their feelings and thoughts, or they might spend less time than a lot of other people talking, and this makes them struggle to answer questions, resulting in the clients giving short, sharp answers or being very uncomfortable in sessions. Internal lack of confidence in communication. So I'm actually not surprised to learn this, but a lot of autistic people during therapy sessions actually check in with the therapist to see if they're answering the question correctly. Now, I do get this sense a lot because I am somewhat mildly autistic, and when I'm in these like therapy sessions, I do get concerned about my answers. Like, for example, am I giving him enough information? Am I understanding the question, and so on. Therefore, I'm not surprised to learn that in all autistic people, this always stems from an internal lack of confidence about our ability to communicate. Also, I think this is even more important when we acknowledge that most autistic people have probably been moaned at for being rude or blunt or not understanding a question before. So this doesn't help an autistic person feel like they have a good sense of communication. I think that this is why my friend prefers to only deal with and to become friends with other neurodivergent people, which I can understand, but I really do like neurotypicals too much to at least not try a little. And I do have a handful of neurotypical friends, I just have more neurodivergent friends. So the last one, using gestures. We have all probably heard of the rough fact that something like 90% of communication is non-verbal. Of course, I'm not sure if that's the true statistic, and I really don't care enough to actually double check it. But the point is that gestures are important in human communication. Yeah, autistic people might use gestures a lot more or a lot less than expected, and they might use gestures in unusual ways. I know I love to talk with my hands. I podcasting can actually be a bit of a nightmare, simply because in my audio booth, I actually have like two bits of wood in like front of me, one for my mouse stand, and I don't know how to describe it really. I should really post a photo on like Facebook at some point. And then I have like my laptop stand, but because I talk with my hands, sometimes I bang and like knock stuff. Thankfully, I've not done that for ages. whereas there are other autistic people that never use a single gesture, and others still don't use the gestures, but they use repetitive behaviours that other people think are gestures. Therefore, this can create a lot of communication problems for autistic clients. So I suppose that part of a therapist's job is that to understand how the client is using gestures, if at all, to understand if they have any importance to what the client is trying to tell them about their life, mental health, and so on. Conclusion. So we're all aware that autism results in someone having communication difficulties, and most of the time, let's face it, this is the end of how we think about them. Because unless we come into contact with autistic people regularly, this isn't something a lot of us concern ourselves with. But as future or current clinical psychologists, it is always a useful work to be aware of how autism could impact therapy. As well, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think there is a single one of the symptoms that is unique to autism when looked at individually. For example, some of these could be applied to trauma, anxiety, or depression. Therefore, being aware of how these symptoms impact therapy helps us to prepare for helping an autistic person whenever they come into our therapy room. Autism shouldn't be a barrier to therapy, and if you're more aware and informed, then you can help change an autistic person's life for the better, just like a neurotypical person. They might need a little more support or a slightly different way of working, but autistic people are just as bright, brilliant, and wonderful as everyone else. So let's help them decrease their distress, come up with better coping mechanisms, and improve their lives. So I really hope that you enjoyed that episode and you got something out of it. I know that I did. Autism communication, I'm definitely starting to realise that in my own therapy sessions. Not because I'm bad at it, but just there are just some concerns that you have. And when I talk to other neurodivergent people compared to neurotypical people, yeah, these things just become glaringly obvious. But again, though, it can actually be quite funny, at least for me and my other neurodivergent friends. Anyway, so this was a great episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you know someone else who would enjoy today's episode, then please share it with them. I'm always really grateful when you wonderful people help spread the word about the podcast. And if you want to learn more, definitely check out Developmental Psychology, a guide to developmental and child psychology, available in all the usual places. And if you want to become a patron, then head on over to patreon.com/ The Psychology World Podcast. So have a great day, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. Please remember to like the video and subscribe to the YouTube channel and follow the podcast on your favourite podcast app. And if you wanted to learn more, then please check out the backlist of the podcast episodes or my books at conwhiteley.net. So have a great day, and I'll see you next time.